Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from London. I'm Paul Henley. In presidential elections in Iran, the only candidate to have criticised the status quo has established a clear lead. The reformist Masoud Pezeshkian is ahead of the conservative Saeed Jalili by more than a million votes. A second round runoff is still likely this Friday. Turnout has been exceptionally low, with correspondents suggesting that that means there's a declining legitimacy in some people's eyes about the system of government in Iran. The election follows the death of the ultra-conservative president, Ebrahim Raisi, in a helicopter crash last month. These residents of the capital, Tehran, said what they wanted from an incoming president.
Definitely, in any point that the relationship of Iran with another country needs improvement, surely the coming president is supposed to work on it.
My expectation is that the incoming president should take positive steps for the country, meaning he should be a people person and be practical, not just words-based, but he should act on what he says.
Well, joining me now live in the studio is my colleague Siavash Ardalan from BBC's Persian service. Welcome, Siavash. Just explain where we are with these elections, because between these two men, there's actually quite a clear difference, isn't there, the leading two?
Absolutely. You have one pro-reform, moderate heart surgeon. He still believes in the status quo. He's very loyal to the regime, to the supreme leader, but nevertheless, his views are completely different to that of the hard right candidate, Saeed Jalili.
Different how?
Saeed Jalili used to be a former nuclear negotiator. He's completely against any opening to the West. He doesn't even believe that these devastating economic sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Iran are even a problem. He looks at them as an opportunity, if not a blessing. And he thinks the country has enough potential that through its alliances with China and with Russia, that it can make way, that it can become a powerhouse in the region. Whereas Pezeshkian really sees the problem as it is in terms of how the sanctions has stopped economic growth in Iran and how it's devastated people's lives.
And he's been critical, hasn't he, of the morality police?
He has called the morality police's actions immoral. He has said this has no place in his presidency if he wins. And that's a huge issue because, as you know, the Women Life Freedom Movement some 2 years ago against mandatory hijab was because a woman died for not observing the hijab. So his message did resonate with some of those people who are disillusioned with the system, but obviously not with everyone.
And there's a potential kingmaker on the scene, isn't there, in the form of the person who got the third largest share of the votes.
This is Mohammad Bagher Ghalibov. He's the centre-right candidate, the current Speaker of Parliament. He was actually thought to be the next president of Iran. Everyone thought that he will be the next president. But obviously, Iran has become very polarized. So on one hand, you have a lot of people, the majority of the people who decided to stay away from the polling booths and did not vote, giving a resounding no to the regime. But then you have the conservatives who have also become radicalized in their own way. And now they have really cast aside this center-right candidate and voted for the hard-right candidate. So now we have Mohammad Bagher Ghalibov. He has endorsed the hard-right candidate. He's got 13% of the vote. So if all his supporters decide to vote for the hard-right candidate, then we'll have a very interesting second round between a far-right presidential contender and a pro-reform moderate contender.
And that happens when, the next round?
Next Friday.
And that'll be the definitive result soon after that?
Absolutely. Just like today, less than 24 hours.
We'll keep an eye on the result. Thanks for filling us in on the latest. Siavash Ardalan from the BBC's Persian service. Professor Syed Mohammad Marandi is a political analyst based at the University of Tehran and a government loyalist. I put it to him that a particularly low turnout in the first round of these elections would be seen by many as a lack of faith in the Iranian system.
No, because if we look back to the funerals of President Raisi 40 days ago that took place in multiple cities, we saw that millions of people came to the streets. In the city of Tabriz, for example, where the turnout was for the election was low, the numbers that came to the funeral were much higher. So I don't think it's reflective of any lack of support for the Islamic Republic of Iran. But I think it does show that none of the candidates were exceptionally attractive.
So the election does seem to have quite a clear result, at least in the first round. And the leader is a so-called reformist. How might things change in Iran were he to take power?
He is clearly from the reformist camp. He's a moderate reformist. He was one of the three people who the reformist camp put forward as their candidate from the very start. He has a strong chance of being elected. I think it will depend on his performance in the upcoming debate. So far, from what we've seen in the previous debates, we had 20 hours of debates between the different candidates and hundreds of hours of each of the candidates being on public television. So far, no one stood out and no one was particularly charismatic. And that's why the vote was divided, and that's also why the turnout wasn't high. It was pretty low. But since there will only be two candidates now, I think that there will be a greater chance for them to express their views and for people to make a decision.
And there'll be an opportunity for the man who came third with 13% of the vote possibly to be kingmaker here.
That's possible. But again, Iranian politics is very fluid. People don't necessarily carry their votes with them, as we've seen in the past. In the past, President Ahmadinejad, when he first became president, the reformists who lost supported Mr. Rafsanjani, but he still lost to Ahmadinejad. So in Iranian politics, it's very fluid. Iranians don't vote based on political parties. We've seen the highest turnout we saw was actually with Ms. Ahmadinejad. So you could say that most people who voted for the different presidents who had very different political views were the same people. So people have on one occasion voted for one camp and on another occasion they voted for a different camp. So I would say that individuals are more important than the political parties.
I suppose I called Masoud Pezeshkian a so-called reformist because, of course, he is part of the establishment, even though he's proposing some changes. There are sociologists in Iran who say that no leader from the current system will be able to show the transformation of society in Iran in recent times. Clearly, that's something you disagree with.
Well, I think you would find sociologists in the UK who would be saying the same thing about the United Kingdom. But the fact is that the United Kingdom has elections and people will be elected from Labour or Conservative or now new forces that are at play. And your government will continue to function. And I doubt that the BBC will call it illegitimate. So I think that it's quite clear that you have very differing political views in the political establishment in Iran. And they make their case on television and different people are elected and the state will continue to function. And as I said before, the notion that the Islamic Republic of Iran does not have popular legitimacy is not very sensible.
Professor Syed Mohammad Mirandi there from the University of Tehran. Now, a new session of Parliament began at the start of this week in India. Earlier this month, Narendra Modi was re-elected Prime Minister for a third time, but with a much smaller mandate after his ruling party, the BJP, failed to win enough seats for an outright majority in Parliament. This is uncharted territory for Mr. Modi, who for the first time in his political history is running a coalition government. What does that mean? And what does Modi 3.0, as it's called, signify now for India? The BBC's South Asia correspondent Samira Hussain reports from Delhi.
A raucous beginning to a new session of Parliament as Prime Minister Narendra Modi walks towards the podium to take his oath.
Main, Narendra Damodar Das Modi, jo Lok Sabha ka.
Members of the opposition, well, they're holding up copies of India's constitution. It's a jibe at the prime minister by the opposition, led by Rahul Gandhi. He's the leader of the Indian National Congress.
Jo akraman pradhanmantri ji The attack that the Prime Minister is launching on the Constitution is not acceptable to us. We will not let this happen.
Now, if day one is anything to go by, this new session of Parliament will likely be a combative one. I've come to the Center for Developing Societies to speak with Sanjay Kumar, and he is a political analyst. Hi. I'm Samira.
Hi.
What are some of the issues that are really going to test Prime Minister Modi and this coalition government?
I don't think it's going to be as easy as it has been for Prime Minister Modi during last one decade. In the past, I think Prime Minister Modi, along with his cabinet, few cabinet colleagues, they used to take decisions. And when they used to take the decision, the idea was to take it forward. You don't have to compromise.
What issue do you think is going to be the true test of that?
The UCC, Uniform Civil Code, that's on the agenda of the BJP. It was on the agenda of the BJP. It is not going to be easy for the government now to take such bold decision, take it forward.
The UCC is a set of laws that would replace the option for Indians of specific religious groups to follow rules based on that faith group. Muslims see it as the government trying to put limitations on their religious freedoms. And it's part of the reason why Apurvanand Jha, a professor of Hindi literature at Delhi University, believes Mr. Modi will continue with the politics of divide. What do you expect from this government?
He will remain an authoritarian person, and he has now exposed himself fully in last 3 months that his anti-Muslim politics is what gives him life. So I think those policies will continue. The policies which marginalize, isolate, corner Muslims, take away their rights by enacting laws, by executive orders, by political decisions, and by unleashing violence by organized groups. So that is going to continue.
And the residents there outraged.
11 gharon par chal gaya bulldozer.
We're looking at residents in that complex, very upset with the fact that Muslim woman was awarded that apartment.
Homes of Muslim families bulldozed, mobs attacking Muslims believed to be slaughtering cows. Examples, Apurvanand says, proves his point. Mr. Modi and the BJP have repeatedly rejected claims that they are anti-Muslim. Speaking to reporters outside Parliament, the Prime Minister said he will serve his country and fulfill the hopes and aspirations of everyone in India, all 1.4 billion people.
That was the BBC's Samira Hussain reporting from India. This is the World Service and News Hour. Coming up, today marks 10 years since ISIS declared a caliphate from a mosque in Mosul in northern Iraq.
When former ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi ascended to make this announcement, I don't think the world knew how important and how significant this would be. This essentially drove the migration of foreign fighters from around the world, over 80 countries. You had tens of thousands of people that would come to Iraq and Syria to come build this terror proto-state.
We'll discuss what's happened since. Our main headlines, the Iranian presidential election will go to a runoff next Friday, with the sole moderate candidate taking on an ultra-conservative. And Kenya's defence ministers vowed to keep the military on the streets until normality is restored after a week of political turmoil. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. The US Supreme Court has overturned a 40-year-old precedent that gave federal agencies rather than the courts the power to interpret the law in critical areas of public life, from food and drug safety to environmental protection and climate change. The original ruling back in 1984 involved the fossil fuel giant Chevron, and ever since, big business has been lobbying for it to be reversed. The Biden administration warned that the court's hardline conservative majority had dealt a major blow to the proper functioning of government. Corey Brettschneider is a professor of political science at Brown University in the US and joins us live. Corey, what did the court just do and why?
It was in many ways an evisceration of the power of government to provide, to promote the general welfare, to provide for the basic safety and needs of Americans and to do the kind of environmental regulation that at a time of climate change that we need. And it was essentially a power grab by the Supreme Court. There's a long, long tradition in the United States of recognizing that we have to defer to experts when the law is unclear about the details of policy that have to do with clean air and clean water and a host of other issues concerning the general welfare. And what they did is essentially eliminate the usual deference that courts pay to the people who know more, to experts. And the upshot is really a reduction in the ability of these experts to do their jobs and of the government in the United States to function in implementing the law.
So who will make decisions about clean water and clean air? Who will enforce them? If not the government agencies, will it be the court? Will it be the companies themselves who obviously have a vested interest in promoting their profits?
The official answer is it's the court, that they'll narrow the meaning of legislation. They'll say when things are unclear what they think the legislation means. And I fear that when you narrow the meaning of legislation in the way this court tends to through its emphasis on the text as opposed to the broad intent or principles of a law, that that will mean less regulation. And so industry will get what it wants, which is the ability to make its own decisions.
Well, the flip side is that conservatives are saying, have objected to what they call unelected bureaucrats making important decisions. How controversial is it really to say that courts, rather than executive agencies, should interpret laws? Isn't that their job?
And that's exactly their idea. I think when it comes down to it, we have to think about what's the upshot. And the upshot is that as the court narrows the way it interprets the law, that's really what we're arguing about. How should we understand the law? Should we understand it in terms of its intent, in terms of its desire in some laws to actually give these administrators the ability to make rules that save American lives? Or do we allow the court, as it's done in a number of areas, to narrow the meaning of our longstanding laws that protect us in these areas and to really eviscerate them? So when it comes down to it, it's true that a court that had a broader sense of what the law was in the first place, it might not be as big a deal. But because this court really focuses on a narrow textual interpretation of statutes, it will mean, I think, the absence of a lot of regulation.
Extremely briefly, what will Donald Trump think of this?
I think he'll like it. Donald Trump campaigns against what he calls the deep state, which is, the state that promotes the general welfare.
Corey Brettschneider, author of a new book called The Presidents and the People, Five Leaders Who Threaten Democracy. Many thanks. Now, fighters from dissident armed groups in Colombia are using TikTok to glorify their lives as guerrillas and to recruit youngsters. Their videos seem to offer the promise of money, parties, and adventure, and all that being just a direct message away. Hundreds of comments on TikTok asking how to join show there is interest. Not even mentioned are the obvious dangers associated with being in an armed guerrilla group. So what does this trend mean for the future of the country? BBC Trending has been investigating. Here's Rachelle Krigia.
The song you're hearing comes from a guerrilla recruitment video on TikTok. Experts have told me that social media has played an important role in luring kids to join these armed groups. Some of the TikTok videos we found actively offered jobs, while others showed what they portray as a slice of life inside the guerrillas. Money, cars, guns, women, community, and purpose. They don't emphasize the dangers of being involved in a guerrilla militia. You're about to hear from a woman we're calling Lorena, a teacher from rural Cauca in southwestern Colombia. We're not going to tell you her real name or where she teaches or even use her real voice, because she's asked us to protect her identity.
When I arrived here almost 6 years ago, the children did not dare talk about it so openly in the classroom, that they wanted to leave or that they had relatives in the guerrilla.
Lorena says a few years ago, her teenage students started sharing social media posts with music glorifying Colombia's dissident guerrilla groups. These are armed groups that didn't like the terms of a peace treaty negotiated between the FARC and the government in 2016. So they kept fighting against the Colombian government and the security forces. Reportedly, they make their money from illegal businesses.
Lorena says at least 15 students from her school left to join the guerrillas.
Previously, one or two kids had a phone, but now most kids have access to a phone with the internet, and they're on their cell phone all the time. Unfortunately, one or two start the trend and it becomes fashionable in the classroom. Soon after, they paint FARC People's Army on the walls, they draw weapons, they draw the flag.
Lorena says sometimes, after a student has been missing from her class for a couple of days, they suddenly reappear on social media, making videos of themselves, wearing battle uniforms, holding rifles, and that's when parents and teachers know they've joined the dissident FARC group.
The context overwhelms us. It is difficult to offer them quality of life, give them other opportunities when there is no food at home, and in this place they offer you 3 meals a day and they're going to give you money on top of that.
Even the EMC itself is trying to stop its young members from showing off on TikTok, according to Sebastián Martínez. He's a guerrilla member of the Western Bloc commander Jacobo Arenas of the EMC in Cauca.
I first met the FARC when I was just 4 years old, and they taught me how to ride a bike. I saw the work they did in the communities.
We spoke to Sebastián over Zoom. He admitted that EMC FARC make their money from illegal activities like taxing people who have cocaine or poppy crops. I challenged him on whether his group are forcibly recruiting anyone. He says not, but he acknowledges that they do actively recruit boys and girls as young as 15 years old. And when we asked about how the EMC FARC use social media, he said although they will publish certain official statements on different platforms, their recruitment tactics are not based on social media. He doesn't approve of the TikTok some fighters have been posting.
Some comrades, for example, let's say, they take a video of themselves that is very pretty because they show how happy they are because they got their uniforms and today they want to show it off and say proudly that they are part of FARC. But then in that video, you show a mountain and you're showing where you are. And intelligence services can say, oh, this person was recruited by a certain commander. And even if that commander doesn't even have TikTok, they are able to find them.
We contacted TikTok for a comment, but we didn't get a reply. However, their community guidelines say, quote, TikTok is not a place to spread beliefs or propaganda that encourage violence or hate. We do not allow the presence of violence and hateful organizations or individuals on our platform.
That report was from Rachelle Krigger. You can hear more on that story on BBC Trending. Search for the documentary wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget, if you want to listen to this programme but missed the live broadcast, there's a podcast available updated shortly after we come off air. Twice a day, you can subscribe to the feed as well if you want to get it on a regular basis. I'm Paul Henley with NewsHour live from the BBC World Service. Welcome back to NewsHour. Now, human rights groups in Kenya are warning that further use of the military to restore order on the streets of several cities could worsen the country's fragile security situation. There are calls for an investigation into the killing of up to 30 people who were in crowds protesting against big tax increases, increases the government has since withdrawn. A new wave of protests is planned for later this week. The BBC's Richard Kagoe in Nairobi has been telling me more.
On Tuesday, the group of young protesters have said that they're going to go to the streets and they want to register their displeasure at the way the police handled demonstrators in the past week. The reason why they're saying this is because protesters were killed. So far, we're hearing about 23, but Human Rights Watch indicated that the figure could be as high as 30. And so they just want to express their anger at just how the protesters were handled, especially by the security forces who they are accusing for these deaths.
There are allegations that the police shot directly at protesters, aren't there?
Yes, there have been those allegations from various quarters, you know, starting off with the protesters. And we have various human rights lobby groups across the country who have actually even prevailed on the police watchdog to conduct investigations into the alleged killings by the security forces. Basically, what they're saying is that the police have been really quite high-handed in the way they've handled the protesters. The protesters were really peaceful until the police, in their attempts to disperse them using tear gas and water cannons, then the whole demonstrations descended and became very chaotic. And in the process, a couple of them lost their lives and more than 200 actually were injured.
And it's Kenyan troops being on the streets that is particularly controversial among human rights campaigners, isn't it?
Absolutely. And it's quite unprecedented because the last time that Kenya witnessed this was in 1982 in the month of August when there was an attempted coup. Yeah, so if you listen to the Minister of Defense, his argument has been we witnessed violent protests and there was quite a threat to what they call critical state infrastructure when the protesters stormed parliament buildings. And so they've deployed the military. And what happens is that the military will be supporting the police who seem to have been overwhelmed by protesters last week, but the courts have said that the security forces will not be using excessive force against the protesters, and the Ministry of Defense needs to provide a specific guidelines on how they're going to conduct themselves while they are going to be in the streets.
The original deeply unpopular tax bill that brought people out onto the streets has been pulled by the government. Clearly, the unease goes well beyond that now, does it?
So it appears, and when you hear and listen to protesters who've been having, virtual chats on X over the past couple of days, scrapping the bill or dropping it altogether is not just enough. What they want to see is changes that are taking place in government in terms of its spending. They want the head of state to let go of senior public officials who have got criminal records and those that have been implicated in corruption, as well as getting rid of offices which are deemed to be unconstitutional.
That was the BBC's Africa regional editor Richard Kagoe in Nairobi. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Paul Henley. It's 10 years since Islamic State militants tried to wipe out the Yazidi people in the Sinjar region of northern Iraq. They massacred thousands of men and raped and enslaved girls and women. Now survivors face a new fear as the Iraqi government plans to close down the tempted camps where they now live, to make them return to the areas they fled from. The move has been criticised by the United Nations Refugee Agency. Caroline Hawley spoke to several women who live in these camps. They are members of a Yazidi choir, which has been performing in the UK to highlight the plight of their community. And you might like to know in advance that this report contains graphic descriptions of violence.
They sing together to showcase their culture. And they know too that music can heal. Their people have suffered an unimaginable collective ordeal, and the pain is still raw.
My name is Amira. I am from Iraq. I was in Sinjar. I live in Khanki.
Amira managed to escape IS fighters by fleeing up the mountainside. But tears roll silently down her cheeks as she tells me what happened to her two older sisters, who were both taken as slaves. Because they were mothers, they weren't raped, but there were beatings and gruesome threats.
My sister gave birth 15 days before she was captured, and IS said to her, "We will kill your baby and force you to eat his flesh."
This was Vian Dakhil, Iraq's only Yazidi politician, making a desperate appeal in the country's parliament back in August 2014, saying her people were being slaughtered. She begged for help to save them, drawing global attention.
And can I ask why, looking back at that, brings tears to your eyes now?
Because with the catastrophe, it is not finished. Still my people in the camps. Still, we have 1,000 girls kidnapped by ISIS.
She says many young women are still unaccounted for and the Yazidis feel abandoned. The Iraqi government wants to close the camps where they live. Life in tents is tough, but many Yazidis are scared to go back to Sinjar. Their homes are gone and they say there's not much but rubble to return to.
The situation is very dangerous in Sinjar because there are many armed groups in Sinjar like PKK. The Iraqi army, it is very weak. There are no anything, no building, no houses, no schools, no hospitals.
My name is Zahra. I'm from Shengal. I'm 28. I'm the office manager of Amar Foundation in The Hague.
The Amar Foundation is a charity which supports Yazidi women with music lessons and healthcare clinics. It brought the choir to perform in the UK to raise awareness of the Yazidis' plight.
There are still too many Yazidi girls who are still in captivity and no one is asking for them. The Iraqi government doesn't care about them. There are too many ISIS fighters who have been released from the prisons.
This is Hadia singing about the persecution of her people. In her mind is her cousin Ghazal, captured by IS when she was just 8 years old. By the time Kurdish forces rescued her, she'd been married off and had two children, who she had to leave behind as she was freed. It's hard to imagine the trauma this community has endured. But the women are determined to raise their voices. They want to celebrate their identity, and as they deal with their collective pain, they ask the world not to forget.
That report from Caroline Hawley, and it is 10 years since ISIS declared its caliphate. At the start of Ramadan, in fact, in 2014, it stretched from Aleppo in Syria to Diyala in Iraq. This video claims to show Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's rare public appearance in Mosul then, giving a sermon at a mosque days after ISIS declared the caliphate. وَإِنَّ إِخْوَانَكُمُ الْمُجَاهِدِينَ Baghdadi was killed during a US special operation raid in Idlib in Syria in October 2019. This is the then US President Donald Trump celebrating his death at a White House press conference.
The United States has been searching for Baghdadi for many years. Capturing or killing Baghdadi has been the top national security priority of my administration. U.S. Special Operations Forces executed a dangerous and daring nighttime raid in northwestern Syria and accomplished their mission in grand style.
The caliphate, of course, no longer exists, but IS is far, far from a spent force. I've been speaking to two people who followed closely the course of Islamic State's evolution. Joanna Cook specialises in terrorism at the Institute for Security and Global Affairs at Leiden University in the Netherlands. Colin Clark is Director of Research at the Soufan Group, a security and intelligence consultancy in New York. I asked him first how significant IS's control of territory had been 10 years ago.
When former ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi ascended to make this announcement, I don't think the world knew, nor could know, how important and how significant this would be. This essentially drove the migration of foreign fighters from around the world. Over 80 countries, you had tens of thousands of people that would come to Iraq and Syria to come build this terror proto-state. And I think, you know, when this announcement was made a decade ago, we were in the really early stages of this. We were then consumed by this wave of terrorism that swept the globe in the preceding years and put together a global coalition to defeat it, which took many more years.
Joanna, did it take intelligence communities by surprise when the caliphate was declared?
I think the emergence of the caliphate was really a perfect storm of some factors that could have been clearly identified and some that were really unpredicted. And the legacy of the Arab Spring and the results of that, so for example, the civil war in Syria, was one of these factors that did help facilitate in some ways the emergence of the caliphate. And at that time in Iraq, there was also quite a lot of sectarian grievances present, which also had a compounding factor in this. But some of these things, again, might have been picked up by intelligence services, but I'm not aware of anyone who had a full grasp of what possibly could have emerged in a caliphate that came to be the size of Britain and rule over a population of multiple millions of civilians in Iraq and Syria.
10 years on, Colin, what is going on in the areas where IS used to rule?
Well, you've got a very different picture today than you did 10 years ago. I published a book called After the Caliphate 2019, trying to lay out some of what we're seeing today, and did mention at length the rise of the Islamic State Khorasan in Afghanistan. And that's now the group that I think most of the world is concerned about in terms of the ability to launch external operations. They've been taking a lot of shots against the West. There's been successful attacks in Russia, Iran, and elsewhere, and multiple disrupted plots in Europe. So, you know, you've got a kind of shifting landscape. You have groups in sub-Saharan Africa, Democratic Republic of Congo, Mozambique, all throughout the Sahel that are on the rise. And at the same time, you have other places where ISIS was strong that have really kind of faded. And that's in places like the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt, various countries in Southeast Asia, Libya, Yemen, and elsewhere. So this is almost like a living organism, right? It shifts, it responds, and it reacts to counterterrorism pressure. And that's another area where things have changed as Western countries have really shifted to focus more on what they call great power competition than on global counterterrorism efforts.
If we go back to where it really started in the heart of Iraq and Syria, I mean, today we still have 43,400 individuals remaining in al-Hol camp as family members or those that are seen to have an affiliation with ISIS. 9,000 foreign terrorist fighters still in custody and detention in really horrific circumstances in northeast Syria. And when we look at the population that remains there, it's this lingering legacy of individuals who have been affiliated with the group in various ways, whether direct militants or family members associated with it who have no criminal culpability in relation to the group, but nonetheless are being punished because of the affiliation that our family holds.
And there seems, Joanna, to be a striking lack of international interest in reintegrating them, doesn't there?
Absolutely. It doesn't win political points for anyone to bring back what are perceived to be so-called terrorists. But when we're looking at the population of al-Hol camp, for example, 61% of these are children. The government of Iraq in particular, I really want to highlight this. They are taking such an important step by repatriating those populations from al-Hol camp in a government-led way. And they had to bring back 37,000, or they're in the process of bringing back such a large number. And we see Western nations who are still shirking their responsibilities to bring back handfuls of women and children, leaving them to essentially be condemned to this incredibly unsafe environment that remains in Syria and Iraq.
And Colin, you argue that as an active force, ISIS and its affiliates have got a remarkable ability to adapt and survive. Where are they strongest now? Doing what? And how do they get their money?
Yes, we could look to South and Central Asia, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and now into certain countries like Tajikistan, where the Islamic State is recruiting quite heavily from, as well as the Tajik diaspora more broadly. Very strong in parts of sub-Saharan Africa, really throughout various pockets of the entire continent. And Somalia in particular, even though there's not a robust presence there because that's largely al-Shabaab territory, which is an al-Qaeda-linked group, you have something called the al-Qarar office, which has played a really instrumental, facilitative and logistical role in kind of moving money and figuring out some of the non-kinetic aspects of how ISIS operates as a global network. So safe houses, fraudulent documents, all of these other logistical points that are critical to how really any non-state actor operates.
And they're funded how?
Well, they're funded through a range of illicit criminal activities, and they're also living off of the legacy of what was at one point the wealthiest terrorist organization the world has ever seen, making millions of dollars a day in some case. That money has been put to work. They've laundered that. They've invested in front companies around the world, supplemented by daily criminal activities where they link up with other elements on the ground to engage in extortion, kidnapping for ransom, and various mafia-style activities where they operate.
And Joanna, going back to the human legacy of ISIS, what about relatives who were in Iraq and Syria, many of whom have returned to Europe and are not in those camps? What's happened to them on their return?
What's very encouraging is that for children who have been returned through state-led processes, they've had intensive rehabilitation programs, so a lot of support from psychologists, social workers, healthcare workers, and these children are returning to regular education and life and thriving. There was a lot of fear around these children being seen as ticking time bombs, but I'm not aware of any plot that has included children returning. These children were victims of their parents' choices. And thank goodness they have been largely successfully returned and reintegrated. But we can't forget about the victims within Iraq and Syria who also remain. 2,700 Yazidis are also still missing of the 6,000 women and kids that were taken by ISIS. So it's important to not forget about these family members of ISIS, but also the outstanding victims that were directly targeted by ISIS who still remain deeply affected by the caliphate today.
Joanna Cook of the Institute for Security and Global Affairs at Leiden University in Holland. Earlier, Colin Clark, who's an author on ISIS. This is the BBC World Service and NewsHour. Here's a reminder of our top story this hour. The Iranian presidential election will go to a runoff next Friday, with the sole moderate candidate taking on an ultra-conservative. Turnout was exceptionally low, with correspondents saying that suggested the declining legitimacy of Iran's system of government. However, Professor Mohammad Mirandi from the University of Tehran disagreed with that.
I don't think it's reflective of any lack of support for the Islamic Republic of Iran, but I think it does show that none of the candidates were exceptionally attractive as a potential president for the audience.
One other headline for now. Kenya's defense minister has vowed to keep the military on the streets until normality is restored after a week of political turmoil. I'm Paul Henley, and this is NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Now, it isn't a good advertisement for the transparency of this autumn's COP29 climate summit that foreign journalists have been thrown out of an energy industry conference also hosted by Azerbaijan. Three Western reporters were ejected from an event in the capital, Baku, earlier this month. I've been talking to one of them, Lawrence Walker, who's the deputy editor-in-chief of the energy newswire Montel News. He told me about possible motivations behind what happened.
I think obviously Azerbaijan has become very close with Europe now. It's intending to double its gas exports to Europe by 2027 and is considered quite a key supplier or potential supplier for our security supply, particularly as we are intending to ban Russian gas completely. I think certainly there are question marks over still how close Azerbaijan is with Russia. I think with this in mind, Azerbaijan does have serious questions to answer still. To this day, we haven't actually been given a clear answer. We were told initially that we didn't have the necessary accreditation, which clearly we had. We tried immediately speaking with organisers, people we had spoken with beforehand, who refused to answer the calls or answer even the WhatsApp messages we sent. We had a suspicion at one stage perhaps we needed further accreditation from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, or we tried to at least get through to various people there. And that did not appear to be the reason. We eventually went to the exhibition or the expo, which was accompanying the event, and we were also barred entrance from there. And one man there gave us the answer that it was because there were too many journalists already. He said there should be a maximum of 20 journalists and we are not allowed in. But we did actually speak with some of the organisers as well on the desks, who said that they hadn't been counting journalists.
Didn't you overhear something being said about you?
Yes. I mean, when we were at the initial registration, we had been waiting for a while without any answers. After a while, various people sort of came and went. I overheard one lady who appeared to be a supervisor speaking onto her phone, saying, "I'll take them away." We decided this was probably a good time to leave.
Now, why is this ringing particular alarm bells? What is it saying to you?
Well, obviously, we've got the COP29 event is going to be held in Baku later this year. It's going to attract foreign press from all over the world. And it's a very important event where a lot of the future of the world is going to be discussed, as of climate issues and how they're going to be dealt with. If press is not allowed, or at least is restricted, or there are concerns about how press will be treated, it also raises questions about what sort of questions people will be able to ask at this event.
Obviously, there's an irony that a country like Azerbaijan, which depends very largely on fossil fuels for its wealth, is hosting an event like COP29. You are, in terms of journalism, not a rebel figure. You work for an energy industry publication. How are very pro-environmental journalists going to be treated, do you think, if this is the treatment you've got?
Yes, I think that is very much a concern. It's well known that the press faces severe restrictions domestically. If this is going to be imposed on foreign press as well, there are big question marks about whether the difficult questions will be asked by the press, whether people will be allowed in, how will they select who is allowed in, and will they be able to just decide on the door, as they appear to have done at this stage. Many journalists are just not going to go because they're going to be concerned that this is going to be an event which they may face troubles or they may face challenges.
That was Lawrence Walker from Montel News, a news service for the energy industry, and a spokesperson for the events company Caspian Event Organisers told The Guardian newspaper that a fundamental misunderstanding had taken place, meaning journalists had been accredited for the exhibition as part of this event, but not for what was called the forum. Finally, on NewsHour today, the world-famous Glastonbury Music Festival in England is underway. Coldplay topped the bill today. Last night, Dua Lipa performed hit after hit during her headline slot on the Pyramid Stage. Here's our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson.
Dua Lipa with a triumphant headlining set. This was pulsating pop performed to 100,000 people.
What have you made of it so far?
Oh, unbelievable. She smashed it. She's confident.
Amazing. Incredible. All the way from California to see Dua Lipa.
Earlier, Sugar Babes attracted such a huge crowd at West Holt's, barriers were put in place to close off the entrances. It was a case of one in, one out, much like the Sugar Babes. It's the second time this has happened to them at the festival. 2 years ago, the police shut down the area around the Avalon tent while they were performing due to overcrowding.
It strikes me they book you on the wrong stages. There's an obvious one that needs the Sugar Babes on it.
To be honest, you know what? It's actually quite nice. We've worked our way up and you know what? And every time we've just kind of proved ourselves that we have the great support. And if we do get the Pyramid, then we, you know, it will happen. It will happen.
I now think after today, like, why not dream big?
And I know how I feel about you now.
And when Gok Wan arrived, he told us about his love of DJing at the festival.
There is nothing like the Glastonbury atmosphere. It is electric. It starts in your toes and it carries on all the way up to your ears. It is phenomenal.
Over at Arcadia, Fatboy Slim was DJing inside a giant dragonfly.
How many Glastonburys is it for you now?
It's everyone since 1996. Take off a few fallow years. It's probably about 25 in a row, I think.
Yeah, it means a lot.
Too many to count.
Why does it matter so much to you?
I just love it. I just love it. I think this is the greatest collection of like-minded, beautiful people who just, for 4 days, we can live in this sort of utopian society where we can express ourselves, be free, be stupid, and, you know, and until we need to wash our clothes.
Now, he's a little bit rusty.
And he'd had a busy day. Earlier on the Pyramid Stage, during Paul Heaton's set, he was part of a hugely unexpected House Martins reunion, the band they were both in back in the 80s.
What a good place to be, don't believe that.
38 years ago, I made my Glastonbury debut on the Pyramid Stage with the House Martins, and Paul beautifully asked me to come and join him on stage, so I got up and played Happy Hour, which was a just really emotional moment for me.
When did you last perform together on stage anywhere?
1988.
Seriously,
yeah. 1988?
When the House Martins split up, you've never been back
and
on
we
together.
Did, we did swear we would never reform.
It's going to start the questions, isn't it?
That I can stop the rumours right now.
Happy hour indeed. Glastonbury's ready for another 24 happy hours.
BBC's Colin Patterson at Glastonbury. That was NewsHour. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye for now.